Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The FT.
Fund managers are cutting charges ahead of a ban on commission, but how are financial advisers behaving? High street names are paying more than 5% interest, but not necessarily the ones you'd expect. And UK mortgage rates are still edging up, but it's your holiday home that could soon cost a plenty. All this to come on this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent. I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Alice Ross.
Hello.
And Tanya Poley.
Hi.
And our special studio guest, Patrick Connolly, Head of Communications at independent advice firm AWD Chase de Vere.
Hello there.
So let's start with the money news. Last week, Schroders became the latest fund manager to cut its annual charges ahead of the ban on paying commission to advisers, which comes into force at the end of 2012. JP Morgan has already launched a low-cost fund, which doesn't pass on the 0.5% cost of adviser commission to its investors. But how are financial advisers adjusting to a future in which they'll have to charge fees for the work they do rather than receiving a cut of the investments they sell? New evidence suggests that old habits may be dying hard, with some advisers continuing to squeeze out as much commission as possible and others churning their clients' portfolios to rack up extra fees. Alice, you've been monitoring this transition from commission to fee-based advice, but some of these developments sound a bit worrying.
They do. I mean, it comes down to the basic problem that however much regulation you throw at a problem, if people want to get around the rules, there are always ways for them to do that. And, you know, some of the less scrupulous commission-based advisors who did used to recommend your product just purely because it paid, say, 8% commission and not because it was good for you. These people, if they move into charging fees, will probably find that there are ways to, you know, give you bad advice based on fees just as there was based on commission.
And I suppose because we've still got almost 2 years to go until commission is banned, there remains this opportunity for the less scrupulous or the more commission incentivized, depending on your point of view, to make hay while the sun shines.
There is, yeah, there's a strong element of this, actually, that a few people have been talking to me about, mostly off the record, because nobody quite likes to point the finger at fellow financial advisors. But some actual statistics seem to back this up as well. So there's a recent report from DeFacto, which interviewed 500 financial advisors, so a fairly good segment, and it found that there'd actually been a rise in commission-based advisors from 2009 to 2010, as well as from 2008 to 2009. Now, that goes completely against what you would expect, because what's supposed to be happening is that all financial advisors are supposed to be moving to a fee-based model or leaving the industry altogether, which some people think that a lot of people will do. But I mean, really, one of the only interpretations of those figures is that they're doing, you know, they're getting as much commission as they can while they can.
Exactly. And the move to fee-based advice, in theory, sounds like it will eradicate this particular problem. But it sounds like you've been hearing suggestions that it might not be the sort of panacea that many hope it will be.
Yeah. I mean, it's commission-based advisors, funnily enough, that have been saying this to me. So there's a certain amount of mudslinging. But there is this fear that if you suddenly have to justify the fees that you're charging, which will be an obvious amount of money, say £200 or something, which it wasn't obvious under the commission model, people will say, well, what am I going to get for this £200 or £500? And, you know, advisors will possibly feel under some pressure to demonstrate that they are giving value for money. And that could come in the form of switching people's portfolios around more than is necessary to say, well, look at this, you know, you were underperforming for 3 months, so I've changed you into a new fund, which is ridiculous. You know, you shouldn't change funds over that much.
Yes, I suppose the sort of professionalisation of the industry would then lay people open to the same sort of accusations that are sometimes levelled at solicitors or management consultants, that they just bill and bill and bill and bill.
Mm, exactly. That's the problem that might happen.
And Patrick, I mean, obviously, you operate in this particular mm-hmm. area. Now, some firms are obviously well prepared for moving to fees, others less so. I mean, does any of this sound familiar to you?
I'm quite surprised by the information that's come through there. In my experience, and we speak to lots of other firms of independent financial advisors in the industry, and even if they haven't moved to fees yet from commissions, they're very much gearing up to do that. So I'm surprised we're seeing an increase in the amount of commissions. I would expect the trend to be the opposite, but really not coming through probably until the end of 2011 and into 2012.
So, Alice, I suppose the onus, as ever, is on you, the private investor, the client, to make sure that your advisor is billing correctly.
Exactly. So now you have to do two things. You have to check how much commission is coming out of the product if your advisor is commission-based, and if you think it's very high, you should probably question that. And if you're being charged fees, make sure that you're happy with how much advice you're getting, and don't necessarily think that the more advice you get, the better.
Exactly. Well, Alice, thank you very much for that. And for more on both advisors' fees and commissions, as well as the new lower charging funds, look out for Alice's articles in the Money section of this weekend's FT and on our website at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, why fixed-rate mortgages for European properties are already starting to soar. First, though, retail bonds. This week, a big high street name gave savers the opportunity to invest in a 5-year bond and earn 6.5% interest. But it wasn't a bank, and it wasn't a savings bond. It was actually John Lewis's new retail bond, which will pay a fixed annual income of 4.5% in cash, with a further 2% in the form of gift vouchers. Then, the next day, a more familiar name, Lloyds TSB, announced a 5.5-year corporate bond available to retail investors paying a fixed rate of 5.5% a year. Both look a lot more attractive than the 5-year savings accounts available on the high street, which pay no more than 5% interest. But, Patrick, these bonds, the John Lewis bond and also the Lloyds TSB, bond, are very different investments to a savings account, aren't they?
Yeah, very much so. And there's a risk that people will perceive they are a savings account because they're coming from trusted brands. They're coming from John Lewis that people know and trust, and they're coming from Lloyds that people know and trust as well. But these are not savings accounts. As you say, they're corporate bonds, and they're relying on those firms to still be in existence and be able to pay back investors money. Now, you take a step back and you say, well, there's no doubt those firms will be around in 5 years' time. We would have said the same about the high street banks that needed to be bailed out. We've seen the problems that have happened with BP. If you go back in time, the likes of Marconi as well, just because a company looks like it's strong and secure doesn't necessarily mean it will be there and it will be able to meet the obligations that it set.
Because these bonds, well, they work like any other bond, I suppose, in that you, the investor, are lending money to a company and you're reliant upon the company being able to not only pay you the interest on the money that it's borrowed from you, but also to return your capital at the end of the term. And I suppose people may not realise that the deposit protection that's available on savings is not applicable here.
Correct. It's a big difference. If you put money into a Bank of Building Society account, you're covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme up to £85,000. If you put money into an investment fund, you're covered by the scheme up to £50,000. With these particular products, you're not covered at all. So you need to bear that in mind as well when you're considering whether to invest.
And you mentioned funds being covered by deposit or investor protection in the case of funds. Corporate bond funds can yield similar sort of levels of income to these individual corporate bonds. Does that make them more attractive, do you think, to private investors?
We would certainly recommend collective corporate bond funds rather than individual funds because you're investing in a whole range of companies rather than relying on one. Corporate bond funds as well are easier to put into an ISA, and the yields on them on a blue chip corporate bond fund tend to be somewhere in the region of 4-6%, so not a million miles away from where we are here. If you want to invest in less secure companies, you can achieve a higher yield. But in terms of a comparison, 4-6% you can get in a good quality corporate bond fund.
And I suppose the ISA qualifications is a very good point, because if you're earning interest from your investment, you want to keep that as sort of tax efficient as you possibly can. The John Lewis bond is not ISA qualifying, as far as I'm aware.
Correct. And so a basic rate taxpayer will pay 20% tax. A 40% taxpayer clearly will pay 40% tax on that as well. And it's important to recognise that part of the John Lewis payout comes in the form of vouchers, but all of the tax is collected on the cash payout that you get back as well. So you're actually going to pay tax of more than 20 or 40% on the particular cash element.
So the 4.5% which comes in cash is going to bear the full brunt of the tax on the 6.5% total.
Absolutely correct.
Coupon. Well, that makes it look a little bit less attractive. For those listeners who might be more interested in a corporate bond fund, are there any in particular that you like the look of?
There are. It depends how much risk you're willing to take. But if you're investing in the stronger companies, the more secure companies, investment grade bonds, we like the M&G corporate bond fund. We use the Invesco Perpetual corporate bond fund. And there are a number of other good quality funds out there.
And I suppose just one last thing to mention. At a time when inflation is creeping up and there are expectations that interest rates will have to start rising at some point, fixed income investments like individual corporate bonds and indeed corporate bond funds to an extent might become less attractive. Are there any funds that you think are better placed than others to ride out this interest rate risk?
Yeah, it's a big risk whether you're looking at corporate bonds or whether you're looking at savings accounts. The best rates available now involve you locking in your money for 4 or 5 years. And if interest rates go up, then those rates become less competitive. In terms of the best approach, that really depends on what's going to happen to interest rates. If they stay at the current levels, then those fixed rate terms will look very competitive. If interest rates rise, then they won't. I don't know the answer. Do you know the answer?
I don't know the answer, which does actually lead me on to just one other consideration, which is if you don't know the answer, and neither of us do, I suppose you also want to be able to take your money out if you need to and put it somewhere else. And you can't do that with this John Lewis bond, can you?
It's very difficult because there isn't a ready-made secondary market for it. So with regard to the John Lewis bond and with regard to a lot of fixed-term savings accounts, you only put money in there that you can afford to tie up and you know you're not going to need access to.
So you need to be aware of the risks if you're making this 5-year commitment. Patrick, thanks very much indeed for that. And for more on the pros and cons of investing in individual corporate bonds rather than bond funds or indeed savings accounts, have a look at the feature, which will be in the money section of this weekend's FT and on our website at ft.com/money. And finally today, European mortgages. While mortgage rates have been edging up in the UK, the cost of fixed-rate mortgages in popular second home destinations across Europe has been rising much faster, by as much as 1% since the start of the year. And they look set to increase further, mortgage brokers have been warning. Fixed-rate loans have soared in recent months in reaction to the widespread view that the European Central Bank will raise interest rates. Last week, the bank signalled that rates could rise as early as next month. So, while a stronger pound and a weaker euro may make a holiday home look cheaper in Europe, mortgage brokers are advising UK buyers to secure a cheap fixed rate while they can. Tanya, how are these rates changing? It seems that they have been moving a lot faster than I was aware.
Yeah, well, basically, we've had this situation that over the last 2 years. Obviously, the European Central Bank rate has been at sort of a historic low of 1%. And even last September, I think there was research that showed that French mortgage rates were a historic low since the post-war period. So we've had, like, most second holiday buyers have been able to kind of take advantage of these low rates. But since the new year, we have seen kind of a lot of the overseas mortgage lenders pull their rates and increase them quite a bit. So, for example, Credit Francais International, which is a French bank, basically increased the price of its 10-year fixed rate mortgage from 3.7% in February to 4.1% in March. They do tend to kind of give you the kind of a bit of a longer leeway, so they tend to say in the next month they'll be increasing it to this. Well, that's not quite the same in the UK mortgage market. They tend to pull rates often without any notice at all. So maybe that's one kind of advantage of the European mortgage market.
Yeah, and I seem to remember, probably having read one of your articles last year, in fact, that there were a number of very attractive rates, all beginning with a 3. And it seems like these have pretty much started to disappear.
Is this overseas or the UK?
Yes. Well, I suppose it's a similar thing has been happening in the UK, but it seems to be happening faster in Europe.
I think it's especially, I mean, like you mentioned before, I mean, the European Central Bank has been saying that they're going to be looking to raise interest rates. And obviously last week they kind of made signals that it would be as early as next month. So I think there has been this kind of almost
bit more of a rush than in the UK mortgage market, because obviously we kind of expect interest rates to rise perhaps maybe towards the end of this year or perhaps sooner, who knows. So I think there has been a bit more of a rush, because I feel like obviously with some of the European countries, they are going through quite a lot of economic turmoil. Portugal is one example of a place where it's having a lot of difficulties at the moment. And that's actually one of the countries where you kind of get in the fixed rates are actually kind of massively more expensive than, say, it's in, say, in France, which is another traditional second home destination. So with Portugal, you're kind of more likely looking at rates around the 7% mark for a kind of full-term mortgage.
7%?
Around the 7%. While in France, you can still get a mortgage around sort of 4%. So it's quite different from each different country.
I suppose that's one thing that people need to really bear in mind. You might think it's the Eurozone, but not all lenders are active in all markets, and not all rates apply to all countries.
Yeah, it's worthwhile, actually. I mean, one of the international mortgage brokers, International Private Finance, have actually just last week, they've launched this new rate update service for their clients. So they're actually, if you register on their service and you're looking to buy a overseas home, they will actually send you an email or a text message to let you know when they've been alerted by lenders if they're planning on increasing their rates. So kind of if you're at that process where you're kind of, you know, considering buying a property, you could almost move quite quickly once you get this text message and say, OK, I know that they're going to raise by this amount mark. I want to secure this rate now. And you can get an agreement in principle to kind of secure that rate. So it's quite a good service being offered.
That's certainly better than the situation over here, as you alluded to earlier, where rates just disappear.
Yeah.
You know, 24
most people,
hours.
Yeah, most people have like kind of, you know, almost put in an application and they kind of, you know, can't access that rate anymore.
Yeah, and just finally, of the various countries that you've been looking at, where are the cheapest mortgage deals generally available?
It still tends to be France, which is quite good news, because obviously that's the most popular second home destination for people in the UK. You can kind of still get a 20-year fix at 3.99%, and that's actually available up to 80% loan to value, so you can even still access these quite cheap rates.
And 20-year fix?
Yes. I mean, that's one thing to point out. In the European mortgage markets, people do tend to fix for a longer period. It's not necessarily 5 years. It tends to be a 10-year or 20-year period. And also, in comparison, in Spain, you can get a kind of 20-year fix at 5.75%, but that's available up to 60% loan-to-value. So if you take the France example, that's much more cheaper than what we're seeing over in the UK mortgage market. So at the moment, you can get, I think the best buy a five-year fix is around 4.59%, and that's only up to 65% loan-to-value from First Direct.
It would pay to move to France almost, it sounds like you have to move pretty fast to get the rate before it goes up. Tanya, thanks very much indeed for that. And for more on the best mortgage rates for property purchases in a range of European countries, look out for Tanya's article in the Money section of this weekend's FT. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you'll find all of these stories, plus daily news updates, top tips and our latest ISA Q&A on our website at ft.com/money. And if you have a question that you'd like us to answer about any aspect of your finances, just email us. The address is money@ft.com. Next week, we'll bring you another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Tanya, Alice, and our special guest, Patrick Connolly of AWD Chase de Vere.
Goodbye.
Bye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.